Hello world, it's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement, of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers, led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call, 1-888-ECOWINES.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code, FowlerShow, for your extra special discount.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery, Yosemite National Park. I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks, along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have. Our national parks have inspired Americans for nearly 100 years. As we approach the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, please join us in helping to protect our national park legacy. Find out how at www.npca.org.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and I have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without big brothers, big sisters. I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything. At a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil. And Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Good afternoon, America. This is Mark Levine. That music is Javier Suarez. He is a Spanish artist that actually my intern, David Byfield, found for me, and I love it. It's non-copyrighted music. I can play as much as I want, but more importantly, it's good music. And it's kind of peppy, kind of lively. I like my opening music. This is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Got a lot to talk about today. Everything from some of the issues we talked about in the Raucous Caucus, the Supreme Court decision to finally take up the issue of same-sex marriage. The fiscal cliff is a perennial discussion. It's going to be until something is resolved. But I want to start out by talking about the Middle East, because I got to tell you something. I think these very, very important stories are getting lost in because of the fiscal cliff and, you know, Washington navel-gazing, you know, fighting with each other. Fighting in Washington, that's nothing new, right? I worked in Congress. I can tell you that fighting in Congress is old. But what's going on in the Middle East, that is new. And so I'm going to talk about Egypt and Syria and Israel and Gaza and all that stuff. But first, I want to make an announcement, one I'm very, very proud to announce right here on We Act Radio. I'll be announcing it, and you'll be hearing throughout really the next couple weeks. On Tuesday, December 18th, that's a week from Tuesday, at 7 o'clock p.m. right here in We Act Radio Studios, 1919 Martin Luther King Avenue, Junior Avenue, Southeast Washington, D.C., The great Congressman Barney Frank, my former boss, will be here along with the great Congressman John Conyers, two leading lions of the House. I can't think of two Democrats that are more essential and more important to passing progressive legislation than Congressman Barney Frank and Congressman John Conyers. Between them, they have been in Congress more than 70 years. So, Congressman Barney Frank, as you probably know, is retiring, and this will be his swan song. This may be the last speech he gives as a sitting congressman. You're not going to want to miss this. It's a fundraiser for the Inside Scoop and for We Act Radio. We're going to have more details on my website at marklevinetalk.com, on my fan page, the Mark Levine fan page on Facebook. None of it's posted there yet. I'm announcing it here first. Then we're going to post it and hopefully get a big crowd here. You're going to want to hear the final words of Congressman Barney Frank. He is someone who has fought all the leading battles. Obviously, he's the first member of Congress to openly come out as gay. When he did it, it was an extremely brave and honorable thing to do. Now there's 7 or 8 members of Congress who are gay or lesbian or bisexual. But when Congressman Barney Frank did it, it was unheard of. And he actually sacrificed. He famously says that Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill told him, Barney, he was disappointed that Barney came out because he said, you could have been our first Jewish Speaker of the House. And maybe Barney Frank could have been Speaker of the House, but he decided that he was going to be honest and true to himself and to all the Americans who are gay or lesbian or bisexual and come out. But Barney Frank is not just known for that. That would be enough. That would be enough. But Barney Frank, of course, is the author of the Dodd-Frank legislation. It is the legislation to finally cut down on the power of big banks, financial service companies that are too big to fail, to protect our economy from some of the awfulness that happened in 2008, and a whole host of other things that you probably don't even know. He's actually one of the forerunners of immigration law. I mean, he's very strong in supporting immigration rights. He is strong in supporting rights for women, strong in supporting gun control. This is a guy who's been really on the forefront of progressive legislation. Well, let's see, since 1978, so 34 years. He is retiring. You've probably seen there's a front page article in the Washington Post. But we have him here at We Act Radio. And Barney, if you've never heard him speak before, particularly in person, I got to tell you something. Every year, the staff of Congress votes, and this is Democrats and Republicans get together, the staff votes on members of Congress, superlatives. They have best looking members of Congress. Barney didn't win that one. They have, the most athletic or the wonkiest or the, most conservative, most liberal. Barney wins consistently in two categories every year. He's always voted the most brilliant man of Congress because the guy is smart. And he's also voted the most funny man in Congress because he is hilarious. His wit is dangerous, and he uses it as a weapon. And if you've ever seen him argue against Republicans, it's funny. I used to watch him get up to speak in the House and watch the Republicans scurry out the door. They won't like this analogy, but I think of it like, rats when the ship starts sinking. I mean, they would run. They would run because none of them wanted to be up against Barney's caustic wit, and they would run away. I'd never forget, speaking of the Defense of Marriage Act, I remember when he would argue against Congressman Bob Barr of Georgia on the Defense of Marriage Act. And Bob Barr was talking about the sanctity of marriage and how allowing gay people to marry would destroy the sanctity of marriage, at which point Barney Frank got up and asked Bob Barr which of his marriages were sacred, his first, his second, his third, or his fourth. Which Bob Barr had his mouth drop open. He had nothing to respond to. And to me, that's just classic Barney Frank. I mean, he's done this hundreds and hundreds of times. It's going to be a real shame to lose him in Congress. He has a right to retire. He's just gotten married in Massachusetts. He certainly has a right to have a very fine retirement. He's done so much good for so many people. But I got to tell you, Congress is going to be a little less without him. Without his voice, it'll be a little less funny. It'll be a little less brilliant. It'll be a little less progressive. It'll be a little less fun with Barney gone. So we're going to wish him well. And I want to encourage everyone listening to my voice to come on out to We Act Radio. If you don't know where we are, by the way, we're just across the bridge from Capitol Hill. If you're coming from most of Washington, you just take 295, you know, the main road, the 395 becomes 295, and you get off at 8th Street, you follow the signs of Martin Luther King Avenue. It's just one bridge, and as soon as that bridge ends, you're in Anacostia, you're just across the bridge, there's plenty of parking, and come see us. If you live in Anacostia, this is an event happening in Anacostia. But I don't know, some people have these ideas of Anacostia. Let me tell you, this area is very good, very good area to be, and it's just across the bridge. It's easy to get to, it's easy to find, easy to park. So really, everyone, please come on down to hear Barney Frank Tuesday, 7 p.m. But that's not all, folks. It's not just Barney Frank, because Congressman John Conyers, who has been in the House longer than Barney Frank, he's been around since 1974, I believe. That's 38 years. So Barney's been here a mere 34 years. Congressman Conyers has been here 38 years. That's a long time. 76 years. Total. He is still going strong. He is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, the most powerful Democrat on that committee, which means if the Democrats take back the House in 2014, John Conyers will reclaim his chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee. And he's been a strong progressive voice for, well, more than 38 years. And he's still here. He's still going strong. He's going to appear with Barney. And again, you don't want to miss that. 7 o'clock on Tuesday. A week from Tuesday, right here at We Act Radio, 1919 Martin Luther King. There's going to be plenty to drink, plenty to eat, music. You can watch some clips of me on Fox News and MSNBC and CNN. You can watch me battle Bill O'Reilly. We're going to be playing those clips on there. You can watch John Conyers talk about the founding of We Act Radio and why we need progressive media. All those clips will be playing in the rooms, but that you can watch that in the studio. You can hang out with your friends, have plenty to drink, plenty to eat, and support progressive media. Support Washington, D.C.'s only commercial progressive radio station. And really, it's a last chance for you. It's your last chance to hear Congressman Barney Frank speak in Washington. He's going home to Massachusetts. We're going to lose this voice forever. Please come on down. Support We Act Radio. Support The Inside Scoop. Support Congressman Barney Frank and John Conyers Tuesday, December 18th. I can't wait. I'm nervous. I'm excited. And I think all of you listening to me should be too. And folks, if you want to call in, 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. When I come back, I'm going to get on to my main topic of the Inside Scoop today, and that is the Middle East. Because what happened in Egypt particularly is extraordinary and even a bit encouraging. And it's very hard to find encouragement in Egypt, but I find some. And we'll talk about that. And also what I find encouraging in Syria. Again, when 40,000 people are dead, it's very hard to find any encouragement. Maybe I'm just an optimist, but I see hope for Syria and for Egypt and for Israel. So one cheer for each, not three cheers, because we have a ways to go in all three places. But let's talk about specifically what's going on there, what Morsi's decision means for Egypt, for the Middle East, for the United States, for President Obama. Where do we go from here? 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is The Inside Scoop. We'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM. WeActRadio.com.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement. Movement of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers. Led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call. ecowines.com, and don't forget to use that coupon code FowlerShow for your extra special discount.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I want to talk about Egypt because Egypt is full of surprises, but let me give one cheer, maybe even two cheers for Egypt. They're not ready for three cheers yet. But my cheer is for the Egyptian people. It's not for Mohamed Morsi, the president. It's not for the judges. It's certainly not for the holdovers from the Mubarak regime. It's for those brave, brave, a lot of them are students, a lot of them are ordinary people, who came out in Tahrir Square in Cairo and said to their newly elected president, "We may have elected you, but you're not a dictator. That doesn't mean you're in complete control. We want a new Egypt." So let's back up. Let's remember the history. Let's remember where we got, why we got where we got here. Okay, so Egypt had been ruled by Hosni Mubarak ever since the assassination of Anwar Sadat in 1980. Hosni Mubarak was a dictator. He certainly ruled Egypt with an iron fist. Maybe not as bad an iron fist as Muammar Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. He certainly never gassed his people. But he certainly was a dictator. And he did not have freedom of speech. And people who opposed his regime were put in jail. And he was not the nicest guy in the world. Okay. Now, he was supported largely by the United States. We gave Egypt, ever since the Camp David Accords, 1979, we gave Egypt, we the American taxpayer, gave Egypt about $1 billion a year in aid. And in return, Mubarak was a mostly an ally of the United States, a fitful ally. He wasn't, you know, the strongest ally in the world, but he definitely wasn't, the guy before him in Sadat was Gamal Abdel Nasser. Now, that was a pro-Soviet dictator, just as much of a dictator as Sadat or Mubarak, but he leaned toward the Soviet Union. This time we had a dictator lean toward us. And so no great praise for Mubarak, but we bought his allegiance, and he largely stuck with us. Well, what happened, of course, 2 years ago with the Arab Spring, is the people amassed in Tahrir Square in Cairo in massive numbers, hundreds of thousands, maybe probably millions, and demanded that Hosni Mubarak step down. And for a long time, President Obama wasn't sure what to do. I mean, Hosni Mubarak was a dictator, but he was a pro-American dictator. So which should it be? Should we be pro-democracy or pro the guy who's pro-American? And the worry was that the people opposing Hosni Mubarak were not just liberal students in Tahrir Square in Cairo, but also the Muslim Brotherhood. What's the Muslim Brotherhood? It's a underground organization of, it's kind of complex. The Muslim Brotherhood began in the 1920s. It's been around a very long time. It began in Egypt, and it's basically people who largely support an Islamic fundamentalist state. In other words, we might go from pro-American dictator to repressive anti-American fundamentalist dictator. which is exactly what happened to us in Iran. Remember what happened in Iran. We had the Shah of Iran, a dictator, tortured people, trained by the CIA, but extremely pro-American. He's overturned in 1979, and now we have a worse situation in Iran. As bad as the Shah was, and he was bad, as bad as he was, the Iranian leadership today is just as much of a dictatorship as under the Shah. They still torture people. They still mistreat people in prisons. They still have no free speech. And they have this fundamentalist element, right? They mistreat women. Women don't have the same rights that they used to have in Iran under the Shah, where they could vote and they could wear what they want. There's this Islamic fundamentalism. The Shah was not trying to invade other countries. Iran, today's Iran, says they want to destroy the state of Israel. They want to wipe it off the map. So you have a regime that's not good to its own people versus a regime that is not only not good to its own people, but is anti-American, anti-Israel, and is developing nuclear weapons. We'll talk. I mean, Iran's another issue, right? That's a big question of what to do next. Maybe if we have time, we'll talk about Iran as well. But Iran is what we were afraid Egypt would go into. And then we're left with a terrible choice. Pro-American dictator or anti-American dictator. Actually, this is an old problem. If you go back to the Cold War in Central America, we had that problem. We have pro-American dictators in El Salvador and Nicaragua that are mistreating their own people horribly, Guatemala. And many on the left were very concerned about that. I certainly was. But the argument was, well, if we don't have them, then the communists will be there, and they're dictators too, and they also will mistreat and torture their own people, and they'll be anti-American. And the argument is, in the choice between a pro-American dictator and an anti-American dictator, we'd rather have the pro-American dictator. Well, I argued then with Central America, and I argue today in the Middle East, that there can be a third way. You can actually have a pro-American liberal democracy, that you don't have to choose between pro-American dictator and anti-American dictator. You don't have to choose between a secular pro-American dictatorship and a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American dictatorship, but you can actually have a democracy. And you can have a democracy that I think at the end of the day, it'll be for its own interests, as any democracy should be, but I think most democracies at the end of the day will be, if not pro-American, and some will be, at least not anti-American. Because for all the mistakes of the United States of America, and we have many, I still think we're a leading light in the world for democracy. Look at a country like India. India has many, many problems. It's one of the poorest countries on earth. But it is a democracy. It's a steady democracy. Has been a democracy since 1948. And India is, I think, pro-American. They're not, it's not like Europe. They're not strongly pro-American. They have their own interests, as well they should. But I think by mere fact that India is a democracy, we don't hear about terrorist training centers in India, right? We don't hear about Indians attacking America. We hear about them competing with us on the world market, and that's perfectly fair and just, and we'll compete with them back, and they have things they can do that we can't do, like very cheap labor. But the point is, India is an ally, or at the very least, not an enemy. We have our own interests, as we should, but we're never going to go to war with India. Pakistan, next door, is not the same. Pakistan is a new democracy, but it's not a steady democracy. It doesn't have steady democratic elements. It was a dictatorship for many, many, many years. I wish it well as a new democracy, but the democracy doesn't control all the fundamentalist elements. ISI, which is their secret police, like their CIA, they still have powers that the president cannot control. Because Pakistan is not a full democracy, not yet, we hope for them, but not yet, that's why we see Al-Qaeda can take up residence in places in Pakistan, and Pakistan is still a threat to the United States. Not the Pakistani government, but people within Pakistan. So, going back to Egypt. The fear was with the Arab Spring, whether it be in Tunisia or Egypt or Bahrain or anywhere, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, well, Morocco's okay, Algeria, Libya, wherever the Arab Spring occurred, the fear was, and we'll get to Syria in a minute, that we were repressed, that as much as the people were uprising against horrible dictators, and as much as that we would obviously be on the side of people trying to overthrow tyrants, as we should always be. We could talk about whether to be there militarily or not, but at least our hearts should be on the side of anyone trying to overthrow a dictator. The fear was, particularly in Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood's been around since the 1920s, that if the people overthrew the pro-American dictator Hosni Mubarak, that they would then go the route of Iran. They would choose a fundamentalist Islamic dictatorship that would mistreat women, that would mistreat Christians, that would mistreat other minorities, and would end up being anti-American anyway. So the people wouldn't get, they go from dictator to dictator, and America would be worse off, and women and Christians would be worse off, and it'd be like Iran. The Shah was bad, but Khomeini and Khamenei are worse. So if you're president of the United States, how do you deal with that? President Obama was in a bind. How do you deal when the only two choices are terrible choices? Well, I think Obama came down to the right decision. He supported Mubarak a little later than I would have. I called for him to remove support from Mubarak earlier than he did. But at least he removed support from Mubarak before the people removed Mubarak. So at least he was on the right side of history, maybe only 2 weeks in time, but about 2 weeks before the people of Egypt removed Mubarak. And again, I wish Obama had withdrawn support earlier, but better late than never, right? So the people remove Mubarak, and they have an election. And the election comes down to two fundamentally awful choices. There are many, many people that voted. I was pulling for the liberals, the liberal Democrats. But when you've got a whole bunch of society, particularly based on the military, who support the old regime, who support Mubarak, and you've got the second largest group of society supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the underground movement that's been around for almost 100 years and was persecuted by Mubarak, it's very hard for that third group, the people I like, the students in Tahrir Square and the ordinary people who want liberal democracy, who don't want a fundamentalist dictatorship and don't want a military dictatorship, but actually want democracy, which has never existed in Egypt before. It's really hard for them to get organized. So they had an election. The people I like, the third people, the liberal Democrats, they got third. And it was a runoff. A runoff between the old regime, the Mubarak guy, his vice president, and the Muslim Brotherhood and President Morsi. And people, liberal Democrats, were despondent. It was, you know, what kind of choice is that? How do you choose between the frying pan and the fire, as you might say? Well, I don't think it's a surprise that Morsi won the election. He won it by very close, by the way, 52%, which tells you that a lot of people were worried about the Muslim Brotherhood. They didn't want to go back to the Mubarak days, understandably, but they didn't want to go to this guy either. So you would think liberal Democrats would be out of it, right? You'd think we'd just switch from one dictator to another. Something wonderful happened in Egypt last week. And we're going to talk about it when I come back from break. 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is The Inside Scoop. And I will finish my story when we come back.
You're listening to WPWC, We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Take Action News with David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Well, for me, it's always been, you know, you report the facts. You report like hell, let the chips fall where they may. And the truth ultimately is what's going to sort of help our society and help all of us. I don't think progressives want a thumb on the scale on the facts. They just want the facts out there. You let the facts out, and progressives will tell you, you know, we're going to win 70% of the time. You may quibble with the percentages or whatnot, but I think that's just sort of what progressives are looking for, and I think that's where this all sort of meshes with my interest as a journalist. My interest as a journalist is report the facts. Here's what's going on. Here's what the facts say. Here's what history says. Here are the lessons we know we have learned. And let people draw their own conclusions. And I think what's so unfortunate right now in the world of broadcast media is I do think that a lot of conservative radio, certainly conservative television, they're not interested in facts. And that's ultimately where I think conservative media is going to have its downfalls, that Americans are hungry. They're just hungry for basic information, hungry for basic facts. You report like hell. you let the chips fall where they may. I think it's natural for all of us who care, who are passionate about politics, who feel like we have a sense about the difference between right and wrong. I think it's okay to let that be part of your coverage. It's important for all of us as broadcasters and journalists. In this day and age, we have to be authentic. You can't be the person who's up in the ivory tower that comes down and tells people, now you must eat your peas. No, it's all about, we all have personalities, and I think it's being aware sometimes of our own bias, but also being open to the idea that sometimes we're wrong, but we have a dialogue, and we have a passionate dialogue, and we care about this country, we care about this community, and I think that sort of passion is what carries us through.
Hear more from David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on Take Action News, on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement. Movement of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers. Led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call. 1-888-ecowines.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code FowlerShow for your extra special discount.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM. WeActRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. So I'm talking about what's going on in Egypt. And as always, whenever I have a discussion like this, I think it's real important to go through the history to understand why we are where we are. You can never understand the present without understanding the history behind it. As William F. Faulkner once famously said, I'm going to get this quote exactly right. I don't have the exact quote. I don't want to misstate it. It's something to say that... never say the past is gone. The past is always with us. In fact, it's not even past. You know what? I'm going to ask David, find the exact quote. Let me get that exact Faulkner quote because I want to do the great writer justice. The point is the past is always with us and always will be with us. So we've just talked about what happened in Egypt and we just had the election. And Morsi, won by a very close, race, but the people that I want to support, the liberal Democrats, the people who believe in equal rights for all Egyptians, including women, including Christians, in a majority Islamic society, they're in a bind. They don't support the old regime. They don't support Hosni Mubarak, but they don't support the Muslim Brotherhood either, because the Muslim Brotherhood believes in really a fundamentalist dictatorship controlled by Muslims. And the answer is everyone should have equal rights. Yeah, Egypt's a majority Muslim society. It'll obviously have a Muslim tint to it, but the minorities are Christians, and also women should have rights as well. I mean, this is, after all, the 21st century. So they were kind of despondent. So what happens next? Well, what happens next is there's a war between Israel and Hamas. Hamas, which is the offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, a dictatorship. We have the quote here. So here it is. Faulkner was far more pithy, of course, than I am. He said, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." Thank you for that, David. That's exactly the quote I was looking for. The past is not dead. It's not even past. People are like, "Oh, the past is over." Yeah, no, it's not even past. In other words, the past is always with us. Every single thing we do in the present is affected by the past. The past is still here. And I thank you. Thank you, David, and thank you, William F. Faulkner, for that. The past is never dead. It's not even past. That was the point I meant to make. All right, so the past in Egypt, after Morsi wins, there was a lot of criticism from the right against Obama, as if Obama could have stemmed the tide of Egyptian democracy, as if Obama could have said to the people, the millions amassing in Tahrir Square, don't overthrow your dictators. The United States forbids it. What do you want us to do? Send U.S. bombers to go after the people of Egypt? Oh, how dare Obama leave? I think Obama should have deserted Mubarak sooner, frankly. But I'm glad he did when he did, because when the people overthrow their dictator, at least they won't see us as the enemy. Some may still, because we did support Mubarak for 40 years. But at least they'll recognize that our current president withdrew his support before the people knocked him out. But as I said, there's a lot on the right that said now Morsi, he's going to be anti-Israel. He's going to be anti-America. He's going to be he's going to set up a Taliban-like Islamic dictatorship like they did in Iran. And we're all going downhill. And as bad as Mubarak was, Morsi will be worse. That's what the right said. And I got to say, they had some legitimate fears. I fear that. I still fear that. I mean, after all, it happened in Iran. It's not like it can't happen anywhere. I still fear that. But I felt like Obama did the right thing in a difficult choice. He did say that Mubarak did not have his support anymore. So Morsi's in power. And an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, which is a Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood organization that has done exactly that thing, taken over Gaza, completely dictatorship, massive mistreatment of the Gazan people. He's gone against their political opposition is Fatah. That's the group that's in control of the West Bank. And they've rounded up people. They've tortured people. They've shot people. Quite famously, I just saw 2 weeks ago on CNN a gruesome picture where they tied ropes around this guy and they drew him by a truck through the streets, obviously killing him, because this person was someone that was opposed to the Hamas regime in Gaza. I mean, cruel, disgusting group. And of course, they have declared that they're going to continue their war until all of Israel is destroyed, until all the Jews leave Israel, until they have conquered every part of Israel from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And they're the ones who've been shooting rockets over into Israel. Of course, Hamas is very anxious that civilians die. So they've been sending rockets into Israeli cities. Thankfully, Israel has the Iron Dome. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later on, but they have this wonderful missile defense system that's protected most of the people in the cities of Israel. And then Hamas also puts their rockets in Palestinian areas, in schools, in houses, because they know that when Israel will fight back and destroy those rocket launchers, they're likely to kill some civilians. And for Hamas, every dead civilian, whether Jewish or Arab, it's good. Because they don't just want the Israelis to die, they want their own people to die, because they know that will make the world angry at Israel. So they're a very gruesome organization. Israel fought back, and I think because of the Iron Dome, thankfully did not have to invade. But the real question was, what was Egypt going to do here? After all, Egypt is the only country that borders both Gaza and Israel, and Egypt has had a peace with Israel, a cold peace, but a peace nonetheless, since the Camp David Accords of 1979. They're the reason we started supporting Egypt in the first place, we the United States. Well, Morsi showed that he could put the interests of Egypt ahead of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, supposedly the people, Hamas, are supposedly his allies. They are Muslim Brotherhood. But they're fighting to destroy the state of Israel. They're fighting to destroy the people of Gaza. They're fighting for destruction. And Egypt is trying to rebuild. And so Morsi came up with a solution. His rhetoric may have been harsh, but behind the scenes, he worked with President Obama, worked with the Israelis, worked with Hamas to come up with the ceasefire that, and we'll see how Morsi goes. I'm afraid that he's still going to allow weapons, Iranian weapons, to come into Gaza to keep attacking Israel. But the point is, Morsi is not a crazy fundamentalist. He's not like the Iranians. He's not like Hamas. He's someone that we can deal with, someone who apparently and appropriately in an elected position cares more about the Egyptian people than he does about some great Islamic war. And that makes sense. War with Israel would not be good for Egypt. It wouldn't be good for Israel. It wouldn't be good for Egypt. Egypt has some of the greatest poverty in the Arab world. Egypt, by the way, is the largest Arab country in the world. It's got, I don't remember how many, 60 million people, some huge number of people. And the vast majority are extremely poor. And Egypt needs development aid. It needs aid from the United States. It doesn't need a war. There's nothing a war could do that could help Egypt. And I think Morsi very wisely is keeping his peace with Israel. He's done his best to tone down Hamas. And that surprised a lot of people on the right, because they assumed that every Muslim Brotherhood leader is the same, every Islamic leader is the same, and they assumed that Morsi would turn out like Iran. And he didn't, at least so far. So he agrees with Obama, he gets the United States' blessing, he helps promote the ceasefire between Israel and Gaza, and then the very next day, he goes and he does something that the right warned us about. You see, I'm not claiming Morsi is some wonderful person. I recognize he's Muslim Brotherhood. I recognize he has his own interests. Just because he doesn't support war with Israel and just because he doesn't set Hamas loose doesn't mean he's a good man. It just means he recognized that Egypt's interests were not in another war. So the next day, right after he gets Obama's blessing for the ceasefire between Gaza and Israel, he says that the Egyptian Supreme Court, which, by the way, was appointed by Mubarak, and was challenging Morsi's constitution, the new constitution for Egypt that they're going to vote on December 15th, he said that he had the right, until the constitution was approved, to be supreme leader, to overrule anything the Supreme Court did, that basically everything would be in his control. And immediately the thought was, oh no, here we go again. Now we really have gone from the frying pan to the fire. We've gone from Mubarak to Morsi. We've gone from military pro-American dictatorship to, well, whether they're pro-American or not, another dictatorship in Egypt. And I think that's what Morsi wanted. I'm not denying it. I think he wanted to take over. He wanted to get rid of the last vestiges of Mubarak. He wanted to be in complete fundamental control. And I had to say, well, you know, maybe the people on the right were right. You can't just we couldn't trust Morsi, we couldn't trust Mubarak. There's just no way to win. And here comes the Egyptian people. They go back to Tahrir Square. I got goosebumps thinking about it. Having just fought a revolution, having just gotten rid of Mubarak, the Egyptian people come back to Cairo and say, Morsi, you can't do this either. Mubarak, you can't be a dictator. Morsi, you can't be a dictator. We don't care that you're Muslim Brotherhood. The point is that we are going to be a nation of laws, and you're not going to be a dictator any more than Mubarak was. And they come to Tahrir Square, and they come in the hundreds of thousands, and the military fights them back, and they keep coming, and they keep coming, and they say, Morsi, you can't do this. And lo and behold, Morsi backs down. That's what happened yesterday. Beautiful thing. Way to go, Egyptian people. It's so great when the people who are controlling world events are not powerful leaders with shady interests protecting their own pockets, dictators, or people who want to impose a caliphate all over the Middle East, but ordinary students and shopkeepers coming into Tahrir Square and saying, we don't want any dictator. We don't care whether he's on the right or the left. We don't care whether he's secular or Islamic. We don't care whether he's pro-American or anti-American. We don't want a dictator. And they stared him down. In fact, I would argue Obama didn't go far enough, because Obama didn't attack Morsi. He'd just gotten Morsi to help him deal with Israel and Gaza. So Obama really is very tame about Morsi's claim for absolute power. Obama doesn't get the credit. The Egyptian people get the credit for defending. And let me tell you what's so wonderful about this. Yes, the constitutional vote will still happen. And yes, I'm worried about it, as are the Egyptian people, because this vote, which is going to occur on December 15th, actually enshrines the two powers together. It combines the Muslim Brotherhood power with the military power. It actually gives the military even more power than they had under Mubarak. And that's why this constitutional vote is so concerning. And in fact, Morsi said, I'm basically taking over absolute power until this constitutional vote comes in. So the people would have no choice but to vote for it to end the absolute power. By Morsi withdrawing the absolute power, now the people can actually reject this constitution, which would be an amazing thing. They may not, because it's kind of both elements of the old regime and the new regime fighting together. But the heart of what the lesson was in Egypt, the heart of the lesson is that even if this constitution is passed, even if the military and Morsi join together, The people understand this right of revolution. Talk about We Act for We Act Radio. The people of Egypt understand they can go back to Tahrir Square. They can go back to Cairo. That anytime anyone tries to take absolute power, the people have a safety valve. They've got a way to amend the Constitution. They've got an out. They just take to the streets and they can take back their country. And I don't mean to claim this is all good. I told you I'd given one cheer, maybe two cheers to people of Egypt. We're not at three cheers yet. They're hardly an established democracy. This constitution may very well come into place. We may see repression against people in the square. But the fact that Morsi backed down actually emboldens the Egyptian people and tells them anyone who tries to take over this country is a dictator. The people themselves have the right to fight back, not with arms, not with torture or repression, but by simply occupying their own square. So, I guess they put our Occupy movement to shame. The Egyptian people, way to go. We don't know how this story is going to end, but I would like to hear at least President Obama give a shout out of strong support for the Egyptian people. It's hard to do that because we've now established an alliance with Morsi. But this principle that nobody, right or left, secular or Islamic, pro-American or anti-American, nobody should be a dictator of a country. That every country has to have checks and balances and judges who are independent of a president. And the whole idea of separation of courts and the military and the president and everybody jealously looking over each other's shoulder. This is the American ideal, right? For all the problems of America, this whole idea of checks and balances where Congress is looking over the president looking over Congress, and both of them are keeping an eye on the Supreme Court, who's watching both of them, and the media is free and they watch all three of them. This whole idea of everyone jealously watching everyone else. I got to tell you, that was the genius of the founders of the United States, because they knew that individuals want power. And the only way to keep one individual from getting power is to have another individual jealously watching that other person. Checks and balances. So again, I have hope for Egypt. I have hope for the Arab Spring. And I have hope because I think the people of Egypt are going to keep their revolution until they get some kind of democratic ruling. When we come back, I want to move on to some other countries, particularly talking about Syria. Because in Syria, well, they're in desperate shape. 40,000 innocent people have been massacred. And the question is, what are we going to do there? And how does Syria relate to Egypt or Libya, for that matter? How do all these countries fit together? What should the overall policy be with regard to the Arab Spring? Because I got to say, the Arab Spring, I think, is the most hopeful thing to happen in the Middle East, well, in my lifetime. Absolutely the most hopeful thing. And it's scary. Like any birth pangs are scary, and any revolution can turn wrong. The French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Iranian Revolution. Any revolution can make things worse. But revolutions can also make things better. And I think with the guiding hand of a careful president in the United States of America, we can help transform the most backward area of the world to being the most democratic, the most free. Maybe I'm too much of an optimist. What do you think? 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop on We Act Radio. If you want to know more about me, go to my website, marklevinetalk.com. Check me out on Facebook. Go to the Mark Levine fan page on Facebook or follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. We'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery, Yosemite National Park. I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks,
along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have. Our national parks have inspired Americans for nearly 100 years. As we approach the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, please join us in helping to protect our national park legacy. Find out how at www.npca.org.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without Big Brothers Big Sisters. I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything, at a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil. And Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping Big Brothers Big Sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at BigBrothersBigSisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Friends, David Schuster here, and all of us at WEAC Radio are so proud of our neighbors here in Southeast D.C., especially one of our partners, The Arc. The Arc is at 1901 Mississippi Avenue Southeast. It's the home to some of Washington's best, including the Washington Ballet, the Levine School of Music, Boys and Girls Club, and the Children's Health Project. All provide a number of programs and services within the very same facility. The Arc is also home to the Arc Theater, the only theater east of the river, which hosts a variety of dance, music, and theatrical shows each year. Almost everything you could want is at the Arc, so stop by and see them. The Arc, 1901 Mississippi Avenue in Southeast. For more information, visit The Arc's website, www.thearcdc.org, or call 202-889-5901. The Arc, part of Southeast D.C.
You're listening to WPWC, We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine talking about what's going on in the Middle East. I've given a long description of what's happening in Egypt. The more severe crisis, of course, is happening in Syria. In Syria, 40,000 innocent men, women, and children have been massacred by the Assad regime. Now, I've been talking about Egyptian dictators. Mubarak was certainly a dictator. Morsi has tried to be, I think has been prevented thus far from being a dictator. But nothing that Mubarak or Morsi or Gaddafi or frankly even Saddam Hussein did rivals the evil that's being committed right now in Syria. When Barack Obama decided to join the Europeans and intervene in Libya, he said he was doing so because Muammar Gaddafi threatened to go into Benghazi and to kill, well, everyone, 500,000 people. Gaddafi famously said, if you hide in your closet, we will find you, we will kill you. And I firmly supported American intervention in Libya. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people on the left didn't support it. Some on the right didn't support it. To me, this wasn't a question of left or right. It was a question of how do we prevent a massacre? And I think Obama supported the Libyan people in exactly the right way. Not by invading. That's what we did in Iraq. That was a real mistake. But by helping them support their own revolution. Again, I would have done it sooner. And the way we succeeded in Libya, I think, is a really big deal. Through U.S. air support and arming the rebels themselves took over Libya, got rid of Gaddafi, stopped the massacres. Now, Libya ain't perfect any more than Egypt or anyone else's. Libya, as we know from our attack in Benghazi, still has extremist elements. It's going to require some time to become a functionally democratic state. But what's fascinating to me is in the Libyan elections, they didn't have a choice between the old regime and an Islamic dictatorship the way they had in Egypt. They actually could choose the third way. And they did. They supported liberal democracy. Pro-American liberal democracy. Imagine an Arab country, pro-American liberal democratic. That's what we got in Libya. That's why Libya is so important. Well, it's time we act in Syria. Now, this is nothing new. If you've listened to my show, you know I've been arguing for action in Syria for more than a year now. This isn't something new. We have to act in Syria for number one reason, because it's the morally right thing to do. If we were going to stop Gaddafi to save a few thousand lives, well, 40,000 people are already dead in Syria. The cities of Aleppo and Damascus are turning into rubble. In the towns, it's even worse. In the smaller towns, whole towns have been destroyed. Millions of refugees. And again, Assad is going after civilians, men, women, and children. Now, I've had representatives of the Free Syrian Army right here on this show. I will have them on again. I'm hoping to get them on actually my Inside Scoop TV show tomorrow, which you can watch on Channel 10 or in Fairfax and throughout Northern Virginia. Although, if you want to just watch it on the computer, wherever you live in the world, you can watch it at marklevinetalk.com. I'm still planning that, so hopefully we'll get those fighters on. But the moral case for intervention in Syria is clear. Here you have a vicious dictatorship actively killing tens of thousands of innocent people. And if we're not going to take a stand for that, when are we going to take a stand? It's more than that, of course. It's actually easier than Egypt or Libya or Iran. It's easier because Assad is not pro-American. Assad is a Russian puppet. He's under, and an Iranian puppet. He's under the control of two of our worst enemies, right? Russia and Iran. This isn't someone we should want to see stay there. As just on pure pro-American realist interests, we don't like Assad. So he's not only a vicious murderer, he's anti-American. He's anti-Israel. He's not a good guy. He's not a good guy. There are some in Israel who say, well, he's kept the front between Israel and Syria quiet for some 30 years. And that's true. He has. But he hasn't made peace either. Seems to me that no one should cry any tears over the loss of Assad. So why isn't the Obama administration intervening? Why we called for Egypt's dictator to go? We did a no-fly zone and armed the rebels in Libya. Why aren't we doing in Syria what we did in Libya? Well, Obama has called for Assad to go. That's something, I guess. And we are giving nonviolent aid to the Syrian rebels. I actually think we're doing more. I think it's going to come out that there's a secret CIA operation to help the Syrian rebels. And it's interesting. Some of the seeds for this have come out of the attack in Benghazi. So the attack in Benghazi was not so much on the consulate that we had there, but on the CIA office that was in the annex next door. And it's come out, and it's been reported in no less than the Wall Street Journal, that that office may have been helping transform weapons, transfer them from the rebels in Libya to the rebels in Syria. If so, this is a covert operation, and I hope we're doing it. I support it. But we need to help the Syrian rebels. And Obama has mostly, at least openly, just given lip service. Now, he has said that if Assad were to use chemical weapons, then the United States would get involved. I'm glad he's drawn a red line somewhere. And I certainly hope if they do use chemical weapons, the United States comes in strongly and gets rid of the Assad regime. But it shouldn't come to that. The people of Syria are actively fighting to overthrow their dictator. And I don't support U.S. troops intervening, just like I didn't support U.S. troops in Iraq or Libya or anywhere else. U.S. troops should only go in places, well, I guess like Afghanistan, that attack us directly. But just because I don't support U.S. troops there doesn't mean we can't help. Just a no-fly zone, just arms would be enough. Frankly, they are getting arms, the rebels in Syria, from Saudi Arabia and from some other sources. I actually think they're getting arms covertly from us, though I can't prove it. We'll find out later on. But a no-fly zone would be terrific because the Syrian Air Force, is using the Syrian planes to attack the Syrian people. Think about how scary that is. Can you imagine if the United States military used our planes to strafe Washington, D.C. and New York and Cleveland? It's unthinkable. It's unthinkable. That's what's happening in Syria. The Syrian military is using their weapons against their own people. And I would love to see a no-fly zone set up. Now, if you ask people in the Obama administration, on air or off air, why we haven't been more active in Syria, they will tell you they're afraid of the elements in the Syrian resistance. They're afraid of Al-Qaeda. They're afraid of extremists. They're afraid that the Syrian resistance will turn to, well, again, follow my pattern, Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They're afraid that it will end up in anti-American fundamentalist Islamic dictatorship, or it'll end up in some kind of civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia. Well, to understand that, you have to understand a little bit of the history of Syria. And I want to tell you why I disagree, why I don't think that's going to happen, and why I actually think that the less we help, the more likely it is that that doomsday scenario will happen. In other words, if we do nothing, we may end up with Islamic fundamentalist power in Syria. If we do help, I think we're less likely to end up there. And I'm going to explain when we come back. 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. This is the Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. You're welcome to add your two cents. You don't have to agree or disagree. Just tell me what you think. We'll be right back right after this.
Listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery, Yosemite National Park. I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks,
along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have. Our national parks have inspired Americans for nearly 100 years. As we approach the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, please join us in helping to protect our national park legacy. Find out how at www.npca.org.
I'm Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico. Last year, my state became the 12th state to allow medical use of marijuana by patients who are seriously ill. Some people were surprised that a Republican governor supports medical marijuana, but I'm hardly alone. Groups like the American College of Physicians, American Nurses Association, and American Public Health Association have all acknowledged the medical value of marijuana. New research about medical marijuana is coming out almost every day, showing remarkable potential in all sorts of serious conditions, including cancer, AIDS, and chronic pain. But some in government still want to put politics and ideology ahead of public health. To learn more about medical marijuana and what you can do to help, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thanks.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine talking about what's going on in the Middle East and right now focusing on Syria. So I've been arguing for more than a year that we need to do something about Syria. Not invade, but simply have a no-fly zone like we did in Libya. Arm the rebels. Give them a chance to succeed. The president has been resisting this. Why? Certainly he doesn't want to see 40,000 innocent people massacred. Certainly he doesn't. He wants a pro-American regime in Syria. But the fear is that Syria will erupt in civil war. And let's face it, there are lots and lots of different peoples in Syria. The majority of Syria, probably 80% or more, is of the Sunni Muslim group, Sunni Muslim sect, I guess you might want to call it. That's the majority Arab Muslim group. It's the one in Egypt and all across North Africa and Saudi Arabia and the Palestinians and Jordan, and they're all Sunni. There was a great split in the Islamic world following the death of Muhammad between the Sunnis and the Shiites. I won't get into the whole. Look it up on Wikipedia. You can read all about the succession and the brother-in-law of the son-in-law of Muhammad and all the details. But the point is, there's two very disparate groups of Muslims, and they often fight each other. I mean, the Iran-Iraq war, brutal. I mean, a million people died in that war. 1982 was largely between the Sunni government of Iraq and the Shia living in Iran. Iran, by the way, is a majority Shia state that was run by a Sunni dictator. Well, Syria is a majority Sunni state run by a Shia dictator. Really, the group that he's from, the Alawis, are not even exactly the typical Shiites. They're a different minority. But the heart of what you need to understand is that Assad is from a minority religion within Syria that has full power. And obviously the concern is, if the Sunnis, who are the majority of the state, take power, the concern is there's going to be some retribution against the Alawis. Now, you could argue, well, some of them deserve it. After all, they've been in power for 40 years and had gotten special privileges, and that's true. But remember, there's all kinds of Alawi, just like there's all kinds of Sunni. They're not all involved with the Assad government. I have no sympathy for those involved in the Assad government, but I do have sympathy for ordinary people. And there are other minorities as well. There's Christians. There's Druze. There's even a tiny Jewish community. There's all kinds in Syria. And obviously, the United States would like to see a Syria where all religions, all peoples are respected. We do not want to see an Islamic dictatorship. We certainly don't want to see Al-Qaeda in control. And the people who are fighting the Assad regime include not just liberal Democrats, not just the Free Syrian Army, not just people that you and I might support, but also some of the worst. Includes Al-Qaeda and includes extremists. And the fear is that those extremists will take power. Now, I have had members of the Free Syrian Army on my show, And I have a lot of faith in them, I got to say. And some might say, well, Mark, you're being naive. But I've heard their heartfelt pleas. I really have little doubt that they want the kind of Syria that I'd like to see. One where there's a democracy, where no religion is mistreated, whether you're Sunni or Alawi or Christian or Druze, where everyone has freedom of religion and freedom to vote, and a true democratic Syria. But the concern of the Obama administration is, well, we don't quite know who these rebels are. They're a disparate group of people, as you would think. They have to be, right? They came up organically, much like Libya. It's not like there was a, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria was sitting there waiting to take over like it was in Egypt. These are just ordinary people trying to defend their own lives, trying to defend their families from massacre. And so you can understand why they might be a little disorganized, why they don't have weapons. If a, you know, the government started attacking us here in the United States, we wouldn't be ready to resist. I don't know, maybe some militias would. I really shouldn't talk like that because it's not going to happen in the United States, and it's clearly just a thought experiment. I don't want to scare people. But the point is that ordinary people living their ordinary lives are not likely to be able to quickly and easily form a militia to defend themselves, and they might disagree. Well, after a year of warfare in Syria, the Syrian Free Army is getting better. The militias are getting better. They actually control whole swaths of the Syrian countryside. Probably more than half of the square miles in Syria are now controlled by the rebels. They still don't have the two major cities, Aleppo or Damascus. And the Syrian military is still strafing them from the skies with Syrian planes. But there's a lot of defections. And I would argue that the tide has turned. I would argue that at this point, I always thought the rebels were going to win. I thought that a year ago, but most commentators did not. At this point, I think the majority of commentators realize, I think Assad realizes, or he should, that his days are numbered. I don't know whether the rebels are going to win in a day, a week, or more a month, but I think well within a year, we're going to see a new Syria. A Syria where, unfortunately, they still have to bury tens of thousands of innocent people that are murdered, but that will come out of this, come out of the ashes. And the question is, what kind of Syria will we see? And just like with Egypt, just like with Libya, this is America's chance to really put a step forward for liberal democracy. Because there's always going to be these tensions in the Arab world, always these tensions between these secular dictatorship, military, repressive regimes, like Assad, like Gaddafi, like Saddam Hussein, like Mubarak, and these fundamentalist Islamic grassroots groups, but ones that mistreat women and do not believe in freedom of religion and don't believe that Christians should have rights and are anti-Israel, things like, well, the Taliban or what happened in Iran, the fundamentalist government of Iran, or arguably the Muslim Brotherhood or Hamas or the people that were fighting back in Iraq. There's always going to be this tension. And we always, I think, always have to support a third group. This is a false idea with some on the right saying we have to support these military dictatorships, secular ones, because otherwise we end up with these Islamic fundamentalist terrorists. And then there's some on the left that say, well, no, you got to support the Islamic fundamentalist terrorists because the secular military is so terrible. And I say, no, they're both awful. They're both awful. We have to support ordinary people, students and shopkeepers and people who want to live in a democratic country where all religions are safe, where you can be openly Christian or openly Shia, openly Alawi, openly Sunni, and where women have rights. Rights to vote, rights to wear what they please, not naked in the streets, but definitely not burqas, where they have the right to express themselves. To me, there's just these two minimums, freedom of religion, four. Freedom of religion is one. Freedom for women is a second one. The third would be freedom of the press. That's real important. You don't want press shut down because they disagree with the government. And the last, of course, is democracy, is voting, is actually choosing their leadership. These basic, what you might call First Amendment rights in the United States, I think are universal freedoms. I don't think these are cultural. I do not believe that, say, well, yeah, okay, freedom for women, that makes sense in a Western context, but Arabs don't believe in it. No, I disagree. I think human freedom is universal. Now, I am not saying the United States should control these governments. I am not saying the United States should impose its will on these governments. I'm not saying that these governments will agree with the United States. But I think if we have basic democracy and human rights and freedom of religion and freedom for women, freedom of the press, then I think these governments will be less likely to be anti-American. It's tough because I realize that the street could get angry. There are certainly people in Gaza who support, for example, war with Israel. But I don't know that they're the majority. They may be. I just happen to think a democracy is much less likely to start an aggressive war. So President Obama, I'd like to see you do more for Syria. Maybe in covert aid, but you're already doing it. I really think you are. I like to think that you are. But also, let's get a no-fly zone. Let's start getting it ready. Let's be ready to go. The Assad regime may fall any minute. And I want it to be said that we were on the side of the Syrian people. I want, just like the Libyans are very grateful for American aid, I want the Syrians to be grateful. And I don't want it to be, oh, well, Libya has oil and Syria doesn't. That's why we're in Libya. We have a chance to take horror going on in Syria right now and turn it into a positive benefit for the Syrian people, for the American people, and for the world. This is an opportunity, President Obama, and I realize that most Americans don't want to intervene, don't know the details, are tired of foreign wars, want troops to come home. And I respect that, and I certainly don't want to see American troops there. This is not... You know, I didn't support the war in Iraq. Not because I didn't want to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but because I didn't want us to do it. It seems to me that if a people hates their dictator enough, it's up to them to overthrow their dictator. We can help, but we cannot lead the way. It's time for us to get involved in Syria. Conscience demands it. 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. This is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. You can find out more about me at marklevinetalk.com or on the Mark Levine fan page on Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. Agree or disagree, I'd like to hear from you. 202-889-9797. We'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement, of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers, led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call, 1-888-ecowines.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code, FowlerShow, for your extra special discount.
My name is Joe Thompson. I'm 29 years old and have a career that I love as a systems analyst. Career. It still sounds cool to say that word. I never could have gotten on this path without a college degree. And if the college me were here, he'd tell you.
I never would have gotten to college without Big Brothers Big Sisters. I could have ended up anywhere, on the streets even. But college? Joe Thompson? Not likely. My big brother helped me out. He taught me I could do anything. At a time when a lot of people were saying just the opposite.
And to a 7-year-old, that means a lot. My big brother's name is Phil, and Phil is the reason that this 7-year-old grows up to be a systems analyst.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping Big Brothers Big Sisters help a child, and that can last a lifetime. Start something today at BigBrothersBigSisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. Welcome back to We Act Radio, 1480 AM. If you want to dial in, 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797. I want to talk at length about the Middle East because, well, I don't think these issues get talked about very much. We see all these things go on around the world, and yet we, I think, don't follow them so much when we have, when we're focusing on what's happening here in the United States. Look, this is an old question. As I was bringing up before, the question of United States interference, intervention in the world, there are some on the left that say we should never be involved in the world. There's some on the right that say we should be involved, but only to support pro-American dictatorship governments. Sometimes they, on the right, they'll say they want democracy, but in the day, they really want a pro-American government. To me, it's not the pro-American, and it's not the leave these regimes alone. It's helping people choose their own leaders. It seems to me that all over the world, we look at what the United Nations does. The United Nations doesn't represent the people of the world. Why? Because its governments don't represent their people. When China votes, they're voting, one person is voting for a billion people, but the billion people didn't choose that leader. So I do believe in helping democracy around the globe, and I don't think that's a right-wing or a left-wing thing. To me, it's a human rights thing. And though we should help the people in Syria, we should help the people in Egypt and Libya, and it's time to change the American perception. Now, it's hard because, let's face it, there's a lot of anti-Israel feeling in the Arab world. Some of it justified. Most of it, I would argue, unjustified. But it's based on the fact that, well, they basically feel that Israel, that the Jew, there shouldn't be a Jewish state. I'm a believer that every state in the world, wherever there's a majority population, they should have a right to control their own destiny. So, you know, Syria should be a majority Sunni state because the majority are Sunnis. Now, there should be Shia rights and Druze rights and Christian rights, but the Sunnis should be in charge. In Iran, the Shia will mostly be in charge, but there should be rights for women and rights for minorities, absolutely. In Israel, the Jews are going to be in charge, but there should be rights for Christians, rights for Muslims, rights for Druze, and there are. In the Palestinian territories, Sunni Muslims will be in control, should be in control, but there should be rights for everybody else as well. I mean, you can go anywhere in the world. It's very hard sometimes. You know, should the Basques have a country? You know, I'm okay with that. Should the Kurds have a country? Absolutely. The Kurdish people who live in Turkey and Syria and Iran and Iraq are mistreated by everybody. I certainly believe that every people that's large enough to actually have a state and has its own culture, its own religion, its own language, should have that right. Now, whether or not there should be two or three or six Sunni Arab states, I don't take a strong stand on that. But should there be at least one? Absolutely. Should there be at least one Kurdish state? Absolutely. Should there be at least one Jewish state? Absolutely. Perhaps no one has known suffering as much as the Jewish people, particularly in the Middle East. But these issues get wrapped up in our own identities, and people tend to support their side, and they don't tend to think about anyone else. And I guess that's human. I guess it's human for us to support ourselves over our families over our families and our neighbors over the town next door, our religion over another people's religion, and yes, our nation over another nation. I guess that's as human as can be. Heck, we have people who argue strongly over their sports teams, and that's really meaningless. How much more do people, Americans, humans, all the world over, fight over religious battles and so forth? But I think in the recent war between Israel and Hamas, Israel showed a fundamental decency that the world needs to recognize and respect. I know of no country in the world other than Israel that fights a war and prior to bombing necessary bombs to stop rockets and missiles from raining on Israeli cities. Actually, Israel dropped leaflets over civilian areas saying, get out, get away, stay away from those Hamas rockets, go to Gaza City, here's the route you should take, because we're bombing other places. Can you imagine that? The United States telling the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, hey, get out of the way, we're going to have to nuke this area. Or the people of Dresden, get out of the way, we're firebombing. Not to mention, you know, other countries. Whether it's the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the Nazis during the Holocaust, or whether it's Hamas raining missiles and rockets down on Israeli towns and villages and cities, major cities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Heck, they even rained down on the Arab citizens of Israel. We're not immune to attacks from Gaza. It's ridiculous to put these two on the same plane. A very moral government fighting to prevent its citizens from being under attack, and an extremely immoral government fighting to kill as many people as possible. There's no equality there. And Israel, to its credit, has developed a technological advance that we should copy the United States, called the Iron Dome. The ultimate in defense. It actually shoots missiles down from the sky. You know, we used to say this isn't possible with the Star Wars. It is possible, and Israel is doing it. Now, it's not perfect. Nothing is. But they've shot down some 85% of the missiles and rockets headed for Israeli populated areas. That's pretty good. And I'm thankful for President Obama for supporting Israel in doing that. Now, none of this is a way to do the peace process. None of this gives Palestinians a state, no more than them going to the United Nations last week does anything towards giving the Palestinians a state. If the Palestinians want a state, they have to do two things. You have to, number one, stop making war with Israel, stop raining missiles and rockets down Israeli villages, and they have to sit down at the negotiating table and talk. And I don't think the Palestinians are going to get the entire West Bank and Gaza, and I certainly don't think Israel is going to get it. It's disputed territory. And the answer to me is really quite simple. Let the Jews control where the Jews live, let the Arabs control where the Arabs live, and then argue over the empty territory. And heck, I'm fine with giving most of it to the Arabs. But they got to sit down and talk. They got to stop attacking. The Arabs have to stop going to the United Nations and start knocking on the door of Israelis. And raining missiles and rockets down, that actually makes it much harder to have a Palestinian state. Hamas doesn't want a state. They don't want a Palestinian state. They want to be a constant terrorist group and attacking. And that's not good for the people of Gaza, who are going to keep getting reprisals. So it's very important that the world take a stand, and take a stand for democracy, take a stand for negotiations, take a stand for a very moral government that tries to avoid attacks on civilians, and a stand against a very immoral terrorist regime that seeks to kill as many civilians as possible. And President Obama, for all the talk about how he's throwing Israel under the bus and so forth during the elections, he stood up for Israel. So he stood up for Israel. He's, I think, doing the right thing in Egypt. It's a little close, but I think he's keeping a nice, wary mixture of support for Morsi, but not support for him being a dictator. He did the right thing in Libya, helping that people not only overthrow the Gaddafi regime, but actually they thanked him by voting for a liberal democracy in return, although obviously we need more protection for U.S. installations there. There's one glaring exception. That's Syria. 40,000 innocent people dead. 40,000 people. Thousands are dying every month. I'm not just talking about those brave fighters fighting against the regime. I'm talking about their families. The women and children who are being massacred by people flying, Syrians massacring other Syrians, flying in Syrian planes supplied by Russia and Iran and killing the Syrian people. Here's our chance. Here's Syria's chance to have a regime that's democratically elected, that respects all religions. It's not going to be a fan of Russia and Iran. Russia and Iran are arming Assad. This is going to be a new Syria that looks out for the Syrian people first, but also remembers who helps them. I hope America helps them. I hope Israel helps them. This can't go on. It's intolerable. It's intolerable that people of goodwill can see the evil going on in Syria and allow it to occur. This is Mark Levine. I want to recap the themes we began at the top of the hour, talking about same-sex marriage and the fiscal cliff. But if you have a last comment on the Middle East, you're welcome to call in on that as well. 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797. We'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Take Action News with David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Well, for me, it's always been, you know, you report the facts. You report like hell, let the chips fall where they may. And the truth ultimately is what's going to sort of help our society and help all of us. I don't think progressives want a thumb on the scale on the facts. They just want the facts out there. You let the facts out, and progressives will tell you, you know, we're going to win 70% of the time. You may quibble with the percentages or whatnot, but I think that's just sort of what progressives are looking for, and I think that's where this all sort of meshes with my interest as a journalist. And my interest as a journalist is report the facts. Here's what's going on. Here's what the facts say. Here's what history says. Here are the lessons we know we have learned. And let people draw their own conclusions. And I think what's so unfortunate right now in the world of broadcast media is I do think that a lot of conservative radio, certainly conservative television, they're not interested in facts. And that's ultimately where I think conservative media is going to have its downfalls, that Americans are hungry. They're just hungry for basic information, hungry for basic facts. You report like hell. You let the chips fall where they may. I think it's natural for all of us who care, who are passionate about politics, who feel like we have a sense about the difference between right and wrong. I think it's okay to let that be part of your coverage. It's important for all of us as broadcasters and journalists. In this day and age, we have to be authentic. You can't be the person who's up in the ivory tower that comes down and tells people, now you must eat your peas. Now, it's all about, we all have personalities, and I think it's being aware sometimes of our own bias, but also being open to the idea that sometimes we're wrong, but we have a dialogue, and we have a passionate dialogue, and we care about this country, we care about this community, and I think that sort of passion is what carries us through.
Hear more from David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on Take Action News, on We Act Radio, 1480 AM, and weactradio.com.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. Just got a few minutes left. If you want to dial in, you still can. It's 202-889-9797. 202-889-9797 and join in the discussion. I want to reannounce something really special that's going on for the Inside Scoop for We Act Radio. And it's happening a week from Tuesday, 7 p.m. You do not want to miss the Lions of the House. The topic is who's buying the American media? And the guest speakers are none other than two progressive members of Congress who combined have served more than 70 years in Congress, Congressman Barney Frank and Congressman John Conyers. Now, many of you know Congressman Barney Frank is retiring this year. He is now married. He is going home to Massachusetts. He has been here for 34 years in Washington, making a difference, and he's finally going home to relax in Massachusetts, and none of us can blame him for retiring. But we will miss his voice in Washington. We will miss that combination of wit and brilliance and progressive fire that has always been a hallmark of Congressman Barney Frank. He is an ex-boss of mine. I worked for Barney Frank from 2001 to 2003 on Judiciary Committee and Financial Services and Homeland Security. And I got to say that the Congress will be a little bit more boring, a little bit less progressive, a little bit less fiery, a little bit less interesting without Barney Frank. But he is going to give his swan song speech, one of his last speeches as a sitting congressman, right here at We Act Radio, 1919, Martin Luther King Jr. All are invited. All are invited. It's a fundraiser for the Inside Scoop and for We Act Radio. And all the details, they're going to be up on my Facebook page, the Mark Levine fan page, on the We Act Radio site. I'm giving you the Inside Scoop now, but it'll all be up in a few days and tell you how you can register, how you can come. But everyone is invited to hear both Congressman Barney Frank and that other lion in Congress, Congressman John Conyers, who's still going strong after some 40 years in Congress, something like that. Still going strong. He's going to speak as well on behalf of Progressive Radio. Come out and support Progressive Radio. We need your help. That's Tuesday, December 18th at 7 p.m. right here at We Act Radio, 1919 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. If you're coming from the heart of D.C., all you have to do is cross over. There's a bridge that takes you right here. It's a bridge that you can find near the Naval Yard. Just follow the signs to Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. We're just across the bridge from Anacostia, plenty of parking. And there'll be lots of wine and drinking and food and all kinds of good stuff. And we really hope to see you there. We're also going to be playing some of my best hits on TV, on Fox, on MSNBC, CNBC. You're going to want to see me battle Bill O'Reilly, Megyn Kelly. It's all there. All for you. Do not miss December 18th, 7 p.m. Of course, Barney Frank is most known for being the a first member to come out willingly as gay, as a member of Congress. There were others before him who were forced out, but Barney Frank came out on his own. Very brave, heroic act to do. He's known for other things as well. I mean, the Dodd-Frank bill to overhaul the financial services industry will always go down as one of his greatest accomplishments. But I think for gay people all across the United States, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, Barney's a hero. Someone unafraid to be who he is, to say who he is, and to really set in place something that, well, we're just starting to see. What Barney was willing to do back in the 80s, at a time when very few people were coming out, has borne fruit today, when we now know that no other than the United States Supreme Court is going to finally rule on the question, at least some aspects of the question of same-sex marriage. They're going to decide whether or not gay people who get married in the states can have the same federal rights that straight people who get married in the states have, or whether or not the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution will prohibit that. I got a caller on the line. Hey, David, come on in here a minute. Take that caller for me. Let's find out who that is. And if you want to join in with that caller, it's 202-889-9797. You can join the discussion as well. But we've really come a long way. As Terry was talking about in the Raucous Caucus with me in the first hour, it's amazing how far public opinion has gone. Michael's back. I tell you, this is my perennial caller, Michael from the Bronx. He wanted to maybe have a final word. Welcome back to this time the Inside Scoop. How are you, Michael?
Gee, thanks. I am just so touched and humbled.
You are. You've become the single most popular caller right here, and I appreciate you doing that. I really do. No comments in all my long Middle East discussion, I guess, but that's okay. I'm moving back to, I tell you, if you can be in town, Michael, on December 18th, you can meet me and you can meet Barney Frank and John Conyers in the flesh. If you come down to Washington, D.C., I don't know if you want to come all the way for a road trip, but it's going to be an exciting event.
I wish I could, but just like you, my schedule is swamped with upcoming Christmas services, especially since I'm part of a choir as well.
All right.
And, yeah, but, yeah, I would love to meet you guys sometime soon, you know, whether me making it down to D.C. or if you happen to come up to New York City.
I do come up there.
We'll get together.
I do come up there every now and then because I do some shows. Like, I was on the Joy Behar show just a couple weeks ago. Sometimes I'll go and I'll be up there confronting Bill O'Reilly. So for the right and the left, I do go up to New York on occasion.
I would love to debate him sometime too.
Let me tell you something. He doesn't give you much of a word in edgewise, but it's quite fun. I don't know if you've ever seen me debate Bill O'Reilly. It's on my website at marklevinetalk.com. You can just go to the archive and search for O'Reilly, and you can see all the times I've been on the show. Or if you just look at my on the page that says About, I've got my whole video clip there, and there's a lot of debates with Bill O'Reilly right there.
Mark, let me tell you something. I've seen how Bill O'Reilly treats his guests, you and others, all right? And if I was to debate him, if he thinks for one moment that he's going to disrespect me, right, even though if it's on his show, I don't take that kind of garbage from anybody.
Yeah.
He's got another thing coming. I will embarrass him on his own show.
He might cut off your mic.
He won't have to be so raunchous about it either.
He might cut off your mic, Michael. I don't know that he'd allow you on the show. But go ahead. What's your comment for right now?
Okay. Regarding Barney Frank?
Yeah.
Yes. It's kind of sad that he is departing from Congress.
It is.
I am happy for him. That
right, me
he
too.
Is, progressing on, but yes, he has created a legacy, just like the late great Ted Kennedy created a legacy.
It's true.
And there's no doubt in my mind that we will have additional and future people in Congress carrying on these legacies and carrying forth the progressive movement for the sake of equality, truth, and justice. We have a lot of new faces in Congress on the progressive side that are determined to continue that path that we're so anxiously trying to reach its peak. So, you know, Barney Frank and Ted Kennedy and a whole host of other great Congress people that have really served this government that is of the people, by the people, and for the people, they set the examples for many people to follow. And I'm sure there are a lot of Congress people currently serving and those that are destined to serve in the future that will gladly follow in their footsteps and in their examples.
So,
God bless you, Barney Frank, and wish him all the best.
Yes, and it'll be really exciting that he's coming here, right here to We Act Radio. Again, 1990 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue Southeast in Washington, D.C. That's going to be at 7 p.m. You're not going to want to miss him or John Conyers. 7 p.m. on Tuesday, December 18th. That's a week from Tuesday. And you get a chance to see our studios, to see me, but most important, to see Barney Frank in maybe his last speech as a sitting congressman. It's hard to underestimate the power of this man. Like I said, when I worked for him, he'd get up to speak in Congress and I'd see Republicans scurrying for the exits because they couldn't handle his wit and his brilliance. They knew that if they tried to go up against him, they'd be skewered like he did so many times to so many Republicans. And it's that kind of, not just being a progressive, we have lots of progressives, as you point out, Michael, but that kind of active take it to them kind of stuff, the take no prisoners rhetoric. You know, too often, in my view, you find this very strong rhetoric from the right, but you don't find it from the left. And it's, to me, it's a shame. I don't mean be disrespectful, but I mean be strong and passionate. Go ahead.
But do you know why?
Why?
Because we are still at a point in which there is a lot of a double set of rules when it comes to rhetoric. How do you explain that when those on the progressive side, even no matter how civil they are, they raise legitimate issues, those on the right say, oh, you are unpatriotic, you are treasonous, or as we've seen in the Occupy movement, people are beaten to a pulp by police officers that are supposedly receiving orders from, let's say, those top right-wingers. I mean, we see a blatant violation of the First Amendment right there. But then when you find right-wingers that are engaging in hateful, inciting, violent kind of rhetoric, even calling for the assassination of those on the left, or even for the president for that matter, they are not held accountable. There is something seriously wrong right there. And that's the thing that really gets me upset. And that's probably why you don't find too many strong voices, as you say, from those on the left.
Well, let me draw a bright line, because I want to be very clear. I'm saying that I want passion, but I want to draw a distinction that I think would fit on the left and the right, and that I'd like to see people abide by. All right? On the one hand, I don't believe in namby-pamby stuff. I don't believe in just sort of compromising. I don't believe in saying someone's right when they're not right. But
right.
When you call for violence, when you call for assassination, when you use racist terms or homophobic terms or misogynist terms like Rush Limbaugh used against the woman Sandra Fluke, who's arguing for contraception, those to me are out of the range. It all has to do with attacking an idea or attacking a person. Attacking an idea is as American as apple pie. It goes back to before our founding. Hamilton and Jefferson were practically at each other's throats, but over ideas. They disagreed on fundamental ideas. I want to see passionate defensive ideas. And I don't mind when Barney Frank or liberals call right-wingers crazy or stupid or wrong. And I don't mind when right-wingers call us crazy or stupid or wrong. We can use very strong terms to describe ideas. But when you go after people, when you say that some person is, insert your pejorative, anti-black, anti-Latino, anti-gay, anti-women, when you start calling people names rather than deal with their ideas, first of all, I think it shows that you can't confront their ideas. If you have to call somebody a name, it means that you have no answer to their ideas. If anything, it shows a weakness on the person calling names, because if you could confront their ideas, you would. So when people call me names on the air, and it happens from time to time, I say, when you're calling me a name, that's proof that you can't confront my ideas. It shows to me that you know, maybe subconsciously, that I'm right, and that's why you have to attack me by calling names. So
yeah,
I think there can be a distinction. You can show passion for ideas. I want people to show passion for ideas. I am not a fan of Alan Combs. I don't like this namby-pamby liberal stuff. I want to see people absolutely strongly support ideas and call names, if you have to, about ideas. Let me just give you an example. I was on Fox a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pointing out that they want tax cuts for the rich and so forth. And I reminded them of A Christmas Carol. It's the season. And I said, yes, I know you want Tiny Tim to suffer so Ebenezer Scrooge gets more gold. Now, that was a very strongly worded words. I mean, it was based on a story that we all know, Charles Dickens, Christmas Carol. But I wasn't calling them personally names. I was calling their ideas names, if you will. I was passionately attacking their ideas. I wasn't passionately attacking them as persons. Go ahead.
Yes, but Mark, the calling of names may be just one thing, but remember what I pointed out, and if people are not familiar with this, it's happened here in New York City by corrupt authorities or corrupt leadership, if you want to use that term, that people are standing and assembling peacefully, and they're getting beaten down to a pulp, and as being charged with, falsely charged with disorderly conduct, which a lot of the charges have been dismissed, but people are still left scarred. And the thing is, like I said, the two set of rules, that one side gets to speak whatever they want, however criminal or unethical that side is, they are not held accountable, but then someone on our side which speaks truth, but speaks truth in a loyal, patriotic, and a very convicting manner, as well as keeping it civil and respectful, you're either constantly interrupted and or you are beaten down to a pulp just to be silenced. And that is absolutely wrong. And until we start seeing absolute enforcement of equal rights, the people, there are those who are going to feel vulnerable. And if I speak out, no matter how much I speak the truth, I'm going to get beaten up or I'm going to get killed. These are thoughts that are in the back of the minds of a lot of people, and they fear for their safety.
You're talking about the Occupy movement now, right, Michael?
Right, exactly. I'm talking about the Occupy movement. I'm talking about even before that, because even before this current mayor that we had another mayor who was a presidential candidate in the name of Rudy Giuliani. And now we can have a discussion on him on another day, but I'm telling you, there are a lot of issues here in New York City. Maybe not many people around the nation know about.
I'll tell you, Michael.
They only know him about 9/11 and how he always tried to politicize off of that just to cover up his own misdeeds and crimes.
I'll tell you that, Michael, post some of that on my fan page on Facebook or on my website, marklevinetalk.com. I want to look at some of what's going on in New York and report on it. That's it for my time, though. I want to thank you for calling in, Michael.
Right.
It's become the loyal caller of the Inside Scoop in the Rockets Caucus. Very glad to have you do that. Thank you, Michael.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Mark Levine and hosting the Inside Scoop. And I do want to thank Michael and all my listeners. I want to thank Terry DeKester. Folks, we are on every Sunday at We Act Radio. That is Rockets Caucus noon to 1, the Inside Scoop from 1 to 3. Please tune in. Please call in, 202-889-9797. Again, if you want to find out more about me, my website's marklevinetalk.com. You can follow me on Twitter at marklevinetalk. And do not forget to join us for the ultimate experience, wine, drink, food, and Congressman Barney Frank and Congressman John Conyers, Lions of Progressives of the House, talking about who buys the American media. That's right here at We Act Radio, 1919 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. On Tuesday, December 18th, the week from Tuesday at 7 p.m., you don't want to miss it. This is Mark Levine, though. For now, I'll see you next Sunday at noon, but for now, I'm signing off.